I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Contrary to popular belief, human trafficking isn't just a big city issue, it happens in towns too. Today, how trafficking occurs in the rural Midwest. We'll learn about a reporting project that looks at the sex trade in Nebraska and find out what Missouri's new attorney general is doing to curtail it in his state. But first, shopping malls and suburbs may not excite urban designers these days, but they were groundbreaking concepts at their inception. We'll find out how seemingly mundane urban ideas change the way we work, live, and play. And stay tuned for State House Blend Kansas at the end of the program. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Seen one shopping mall, you've seen them all. Seen one suburb, and you've got it. You've seen a million of them. But here's the thing. Once upon a time, the shopping mall was an innovative concept. So was the suburb. Both originally were the ideas of visionaries whose dreams became the world we actually live in. Wade Graham has chronicled all this in a book now out in paperback, Dream Cities, Seven Urban Ideas That Shape the World. Wade Graham is the author of three books, and he teaches urban and environmental policy at Pepperdine University's School of Public Policy. And Wade, nice to have you here. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So your goal here then is to help us see the mundane with fresh eyes again.
That is the goal. It sounds pretentious, but we're odd as Americans. We're very visually trained in certain ways. I can tell everything about a person by their handbag or their car, but even really well-educated people, if I put them down in a street and ask them what they see, they draw a blank. We don't understand who built it, why they built it, why our buildings and our roads and our cities are the way that they are.
You know, give us an example of something that most people find mundane that actually has a fascinating backstory to it.
Well, as you say, the shopping mall is one of the most extraordinary things. We really dislike them. We distrust them. We make fun of them. Cicero said that all retail is base. We think it's beneath our dignity, but there's a good case to be made that cities really were invented for shopping. The oldest cities in Turkey, 7,000 years old, really were market towns. And in Greek, we think of the foundation of modern democracy as from the agora, but the agora was the market. And the same word in Greek is I speak with other people is I shop.
Huh.
So in some sense, if maximum shopping is maximum urbanism.
Mm-hmm.
And shopping mall developers are not just capitalists. Many of them have been really utopian, visionary folks out to, in some sense, remake community through shopping.
This was a man, at least one of the men involved here, Victor Gruen. He's interesting because the shopping mall was his brainchild, but he wound up being extremely unhappy with the way his vision was compromised over the years, at least in his view. Tell us about what he thought a real shopping center should be and what it became.
He was an interesting character, an Austrian refugee from the Nazis, really invented or perfected, shall we say, the big covered shopping mall out in the suburbs surrounded by 10,000 parking spaces. And what he figured out in the 1950s was that suburbia was this soulless place where people had no contact with one another. And the way to get them back together was through shopping. And so he created these environments that were temperature controlled, 74 degrees year round, with sort of benches and street furniture and attractions and different things to kind of mimic an old fashioned town space.
And people loved them for a while.
People loved them. They still love them. In a sense, not necessarily the malls that he made. Many of those, as we all know, are sort of dying out there on the side of the interstates. But, you know, we're really now building entire cities, particularly in Asia, based on the mall. And the mall now is really in the fabric of our lives. It's everywhere. It's in your phone. Mm-hmm. It's in your television. It's at your school. If you go to the airport, you've just gone to the mall. It's inescapable.
Yeah. Well, how did Van Gruen feel about how things changed then for the shopping center?
You know, curiously, his malls were so successful. In a sense, they, if not drove suburbanization and white flight and the abandonment of central cities, they definitely enabled it because they gave people what they needed, accessible by car from these dispersed locations. But then he felt somehow that that he was being pinned with suburbia. And he said, I disavow this patrimony. I will not pay alimony for it. But in a sense, he's certainly culpable. It's an odd response.
So the problem, in a sense, way that you're addressing here is that some of these architectural ideas that we've become so accustomed to, they were so good that they wound up being copied to the point of sheer exhaustion. At least that's how many of us look at them now.
I mean, one of the things that's interesting about the U.S., but also the world, is that anywhere you go, you get plopped down, you will see the same things. You'll look over here, there's a mall over there, there's a freeway here, there's a tower there, yeah. There's a gated suburbia, and they all look the same. There are some regional variations, but they really are the same all over the world.
And it doesn't help by the fact that stores, chain stores, are just the same stores in every city you go to now.
Right. Well, we live in a globalized world, and success is monetizable. So, you know, Disney not only has theme parks, but they have 500 stores in malls all over the world. Because if you can replicate a pattern, you will. So this is one of the interesting things, is that if you would think that architecture in cities would have regional flavor, like the Eskimos built igloos and the Puebloans built their adobe houses. But no, everything's the same everywhere, and it's a bit disconcerting, and I think people are pulling towards it in an opposite direction now.
Mm-hmm. Another visionary you talk about in this book is Frank Lloyd Wright. People will recognize his name. Some thought he wanted to destroy cities altogether, and I'm wondering why, and what did he want in their place?
He, like many people, felt that the modern city was somehow toxic. Too many immigrants, too much crime, too much congestion, and that it threatened democracy in some way. And so what he proposed to do was to eliminate cities entirely and sort of spread all of us all across the American map so we could all live on a little farm and have chickens and have an acre of our own.
Why do you think that was the way to go?
There is a sense that the agrarian past was a golden age, and that's when we were all happy, even though farming is typically you're raising hogs in the mud and you're poor.
It's hard work.
The automobile enabled a dream where we could all live very far apart from one another and enjoy not have the disadvantages of cities, but somehow still have the advantages of them. It's a paradox. But he did draw the blueprint for American suburbia, without a doubt.
Mm-hmm. And how do you feel about that legacy as he aged in his life?
Unlike Victor Gruen, Frank Lloyd Wright had no self-doubt whatsoever. I think towards the end of his life, he felt very accomplished, having helped the decentralization of, 250 million Americans.
What do you think his legacy is today?
I think it's quite a sad legacy because, in fact, suburbia has been very destructive, not only in terms of resources, just because of the infrastructure costs and the automobile dependency, but it also gutted our cities, it gutted the community, and it separated people by income and race, and has had a terrible, terrible impact, and we're struggling to reverse it now.
It seems to me that some people regard cities in some ways as massive works of art. And to that, you would say what, Wade?
Well, I suppose it depends on the city, doesn't it? There are better paintings and worse paintings. And we all know that certain cities are works of art. I mean, if you've been to Rome or Florence, but you might also go to, I won't even name names, but there's some other places that don't make us so happy. Cities vary in extraordinary ways, even though their kit of parts tends to be made up of the same bits, as I mentioned before. But there is a sense, when people have pride in the city, then they will take care of it and they'll make a better work of art. But if people are committed to its destruction, then you see what happened in America in the post-war, where we really destroyed our cities, we hollowed them out, kept the poor in the kind of hole in the donut. And that's been really tragic.
You were saying before the show, we were talking about Kansas City and how our town here has surged in the last decade. It's a fundamentally different town in many ways today than it was a decade ago. And you were saying, hey, we're seeing that same kind of growth and development in so many major cities across the country.
This is really a national phenomenon. In some sense, it's a global phenomenon as well, but really in the United States, We've been whipsawed. In the post-war, the federal government was committed to getting people out of central cities. And so we built highways and we had a tax structure that favored suburbs over cities. And we evacuated 100 American cities.
Because really. Frank Lloyd Wright's vision became so popular.
It was popular. People agreed with him and they wanted a car and a little house on a sort of pseudo ranchette. And now the demographics have changed, the cultural imperatives have changed, and the tax structure has changed. So now it's not cheaper to build in the suburbs. It might be cheaper to come back downtown. And in the past, where a company's workforce might have wanted to live in Levittown, that workforce now wants to live in downtown San Francisco. You know, Google has to be located near San Francisco. And so we're seeing this all over the United States where downtowns are being revitalized, these people moving downtown, businesses opening, just like what you see in Kansas City, the streetcar line.
Yeah.
Going back in some sense to the 19th century.
I was going to say, what is the appeal, the raw appeal? Because it goes beyond tax breaks. There's got to be something in the American psyche that's suggesting that people want to be in downtown populous areas.
Yeah. Interestingly, you know, people said the internet would kill social life, but people more and more want to go out. They want to see music. They want to go to bars. They want to go to restaurants, and they want to walk. They want to get out of their cars. And there's people know that there's a measure of success in the amount of time you don't spend in your car.
Where did that come from?
It's a generational shift. I think people finally got sick of sitting in traffic and wondering, who did this to me? I don't really live in the country. All I do is commute from it.
Yeah. And so many Americans are so stuck with that. There's always a great story that Congressman Slattery from Kansas used to tell. He was in Manhattan one morning and going up in a crowded elevator, and he was surveying the little car of people there saying, how long did many of you commute to work here this morning? And, you know, half an hour, bunch of hands, 45 minutes, a bunch of hands, more than an hour. And he's like, come out to Kansas. You don't have to worry about all this crazy commuting that you guys are doing here. And you wonder how people can sustain that kind of lifestyle year after year.
Yeah, I think it's quite expensive. We know it's expensive in terms of just automobiles are expensive and fuel and living in the suburbs with a big house that you have to heat and clean, that's expensive. And really, the other thing is that density confers all kinds of advantages. I mean, first of all, if you want to find a date, not going to do it on the farm. This has always been what drove people to cities. And second of all, if you're in business, cities have an enormous advantage because people are next to each other and they share ideas and it compounds. And so cities have an incredible competitive advantage. Even though they're expensive and congested, they have a huge advantage.
Well, what's happened with tax structure that you mentioned that's made it cheaper to build in the cities and the suburbs? Because I've always assumed that suburban development is cheaper given the parking effect of trying to build downtown and what that costs and everything else, Wade.
Well, the reason the skyscrapers exist is because if you can stack up rentable space on a small piece of land, it makes sense. On a large land on the periphery is cheap, but it doesn't have the density advantages. So
yeah,
we extended tax subsidies essentially by building the interstate highways, by building sewers, water, electricity. All of that was paid for by the tax base of cities, and the suburbs took advantage of that. But now it's all 40 years old. It's all falling apart. They need to replace it, and they're finding that it is cheaper to go back downtown.
That's interesting. If you're just joining us this morning, you're listening to Up to Date. Our guest is Wade Graham. He's the author of a book now out in paperback, Dream Cities, Seven Urban Ideas That Shape the World. If you want to join our conversation, 816-235-2888 is our number here, or you can tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. You know, is it possible to bring order to something as intrinsically chaotic as the American city?
I hope not.
Because some folks wanted to do that.
People have always wanted to do that. To the dawn of time, rulers have always wanted to exert control over the chaos of cities where people do what they want. And many cities have been destroyed or partially destroyed by that urge. That happened in Kansas City, also in the post-war with urban renewal, where they decided that downtown was blighted and they would build freeways and knock down buildings and evict thousands of people and put in parking lots so that people could commute from the new suburbs into new office buildings. And you destroyed a community and you left tore gashes through through the physical landscape of downtown. And now it's hard to redo that. So chaos is not necessarily chaotic. It might be organic ferment. It might be where creativity comes from. And the greatest cities in the world are not laid out on a grid. They were built kind of the way a coral reef is built by itself, the action of, you know, thousands of different actors. So the urge to impose order on cities is understandable, but it's been very destructive.
Now, ultimately, what does this book say about the everlasting power and authority of architecture to bring order to our lives and shape them in some significant way?
Well, what struck me, two things struck me. One is that architects have been extraordinarily persuasive in certain cases. Most of the people who I profile are very charismatic. They're very, very talented either at drawing or at speaking or at convincing people that their vision is one that should be adopted. And, you know, they've been adopted all over the world. Extraordinary success as salespeople. But the ideas have been sometimes either perverted from their original form or kind of cockamamie from the beginning. Hmm. And so the second thing I found is that the consequences have been extraordinary and in many cases fairly unhappy. And so architects are an interesting, you may remember the Ayn Rand, the Fountainhead, this sort of architects wanting to be dictators. And this is not uncommon in the profession.
I was going to say, so many of the dreamers you chronicle in this book wanted to bring utopia to the world, or at least their own little part of the world.
Certainly. Many of these folks, like Frank Lloyd Wright or John Jurdy, the great shopping mall designer from Los Angeles, as children, they played with blocks and they made little dream cities in their garages. And they just had a kind of a they just had a deep desire to remake the world. And those who've been successful have been, as I said, extraordinarily inspirational to people. And yet architecture is making objects. It's not making the fabric in which objects go. Cities are not the buildings. They're the space in between the buildings. Mm. And they're not well trained to do that.
That's interesting. I should point out that Wei Graham speaks tonight at 6:30 at the Kansas City Public Library downtown at 14 West 10th Street. More information, kclibrary.org. The heroine of this book is a woman named Jane Jacobs, who died in 2006. Why is she your heroine?
Jane Jacobs is justly famous. She was a something of a housewife and a mother in New York City in the 40s and 50s when Robert Moses, the big infrastructure czar there who built all the freeways and, as he said, cut through the city with a meat axe in order to modernize it.
And she fought him.
He was going to build a big expressway into Washington Square Park in Greenwich Village, and she fought him. She organized the other people in the neighborhood and leafleted and had meetings, and she also was extraordinarily analytical and understood the life of cities comes from little things, the shape of the block, the how many people are standing on the street at a certain time, whether there are people there at night as well as in the morning and in the afternoon doing different things. She understood that the small fabric, the diversity of traditional cities is what was what makes cities work well, and that needed to be defended. And we're now going back to her books as a kind of a gospel to how to rebuild.
I was going to say she saw the planning of cities as a tragedy of good intentions that were carelessly applied.
I think it's certainly true. The utopian desires of the modern architects to smooth out the unruly and kind of inefficient old city, like many utopian ideas, it was caught by other interests. And in the United States, it was really caught by real estate interests and downtown elites who found in that utopian idea a way to get the federal government to pay them to up the property value downtown. And the human costs were extraordinarily high.
Hmm. She also had a villain, a man named Ebenezer Howard, who was an Englishman and founder of something called the Garden City Movement. What was the Garden City Movement?
The Garden City Movement is a very surprisingly common idea, which is that the city is the root of all evil and that the countryside is where all things are good, and so we need to retreat to the countryside. But of course, you can't make a living in the countryside. All farmers, small farmers, will tell you that. So he decided we would separate functions and we would have people would work here and they would live there and we would surround everything with little garden belts. And sort of make a hybrid between the city and the country. But what it does is it separates people, different colors, different income levels, mm-hmm. and it kills the vitality. So it's in a sense a fantasy that you can have the city, but then not have the city.
That's interesting. How can people and communities, you know, regain the upper hand here, Wade, when it comes to the built environments that surround them each day?
I think you see it happening all around us. I think you see it happening in Kansas City, the movement back into the center, the decision to spend money on things that we wouldn't have, maybe the streetcar, closing some roads, closing some freeways, redirecting resources to town, and in a sense, just going downtown.
Let's go to one last phone call here. John from Midtown, Kansas City. John, good morning.
Yes, good morning. I'd like to ask Wade about Seaside, Florida. He references it in his book, and how has it aged in the last 30 years?
Seaside, Florida, and why is Seaside, Florida significant? Wade, give us some context.
Seaside was a new urbanist development in Florida, quite right. Visionary, and it was the application of Jane Jacobs's principles of small streets, different building sizes, pedestrian walkability. It's been very, very successful. The criticisms of Seaside are that it's actually not in the city. They built a suburb and called it Seaside, and that it really is too expensive for normal people. And it's quite a lovely spot. I think Seaside has densified in a sense over time. And some people say, wow, it's no longer this utopian walkable thing. And others will say, well, actually, it's a real city now. But to be honest with you, I haven't been there in a while.
Okay. We're going to have to leave our conversation there. Again, Wade Graham speaks tonight at 6:30 at the Kansas City Public Library downtown. It's at 14 West 10th Street. More information, kclibrary.org. Again, his book, now out in paperback, is titled Dream Cities, Seven Urban Ideas That Shape the World. And Wade, great to have you here. Thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
Time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk about sex trafficking in small-town America, including here in Missouri and Kansas. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And welcome back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday on the show, we spoke with Kansas state lawmakers to find out what to expect in the upcoming veto session. You can find that conversation at kcur.org/uptodate. It's also on the NPR One app. Tomorrow, the Kids Lit Fest is drawing children's book authors to Kansas City from around the country. We'll find out why, and we'll also learn about the role that ethics plays in warfare. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, a recent series on Nebraska's NPR stations found that the buying and selling of human beings in that state isn't that tough. Turns out it may not be all that tough in states like Missouri and Kansas either. Missouri's Attorney General has taken notice. In his fourth month in office, he's created a new anti-trafficking unit and created new consumer protection rules that would make it illegal to create a business as a front for a trafficking operation. Now we'll look at what's happening even in small-town America when it comes to human trafficking. With us this morning is the Attorney General of Missouri. That's Josh Hawley. General, thanks for taking some time.
Thank you.
Also here is Mike Tobias. He's a reporter for Net News in Nebraska. That's Nebraska's home for NPR and PBS. Mike, nice to have you too.
Thanks. Happy to join you.
General, let me begin with you. Why has this issue come to your attention so early in your administration? In fact, you've said that you've been working on this issue since day one.
And even before day one, Steve, this is something that was a top priority for me coming into office. I talked a lot about it during the campaign, mm-hmm. and it's really simple. It's because it is a growing problem. It is not just a problem, it's an epidemic across the country and here in the state of Missouri. And over the last few years, the National Trafficking Hotline reports that there are over 2,000 reported instances of trafficking in the state of Missouri, over 2,000 over the last few years. Last year alone, 135 trafficking-related prosecutions in the state of Missouri. That's double from what it was the year before, and we have every reason to believe that this is a crime that is under-prosecuted. So it is a very serious issue. It is a very serious epidemic in our state and in every part of our state, as you allude to, urban and rural, and that's why we're taking action to combat it.
I was going to say, General, should I be surprised that this practice has seeped into our small towns, even here in the heartland of the country?
No, and the reason is it is driven increasingly by the internet. Predators, traffickers lure their victims on the internet. These transactions between the traffickers and those who would purchase this labor, if you will, those transactions are increasingly concluded over the internet. So this has allowed the crime of trafficking to spread away from metropolitan areas. And of course, traffickers are always seeking to evade the force of the law, and they will move and go to wherever they can as to conduct their illicit activities. So we see all over our state, whether it's in middle Missouri or whether it's in urban areas, we see increased trafficking, increased predatory behavior, And this is something that requires concerted action, and that's why we are taking action in the Missouri Attorney General's office.
You know, Mike Tobias from Nebraska, what did you find out in your series when it comes to sex trafficking in Nebraska? How common is it? What did you find out about what's happening up there?
Really, a lot of the things that the Attorney General was talking about. It's common in Nebraska. It's underreported. It's underprosecuted. And yes, it happens in our two largest cities of Omaha and Lincoln, but it happens across the state. It happens in there are people being trafficked in towns as small as 500. One of the interesting things that we included in our reporting project, Sold for Sex, was some research that was done by two Creighton University researchers that looked at, they did a deep dive analysis of Backpage. Backpage is the classified ads website where a lot of this sort of business model exists for sex trafficking. And, you know, in analyzing these posts that are there, these you know, to sell people, they created maps that show where the activity happens. And yes, it's Omaha, it's Lincoln, it's some of the larger cities. But there's also what they call hotspots of activity in places like Sydney in far western Nebraska, population 7,000, St. Paul, population 2,000, which is in central Nebraska, the community of Gretna, which sits outside of Omaha, population 6,000. So it's truly all over the state.
General, along those lines, are there pockets of Missouri where the problem is more concentrated? Are you seeing the same kinds of trends that Mike just described up in Nebraska?
We certainly are, and we see it dispersed across the state. Now, I will say that both St. Louis and Kansas City in our state are particularly hot spots for trafficking. St. Louis, in fact, is ranked, depending on the metric you use, has sometimes ranked in the top 10 cities nationwide for trafficking activity, both sex trafficking and labor trafficking. And Kansas City is also a major site for trafficking activity. Partly that's because of their geographic locations. But here's the other thing, Steve, and this is the part that nobody likes to talk about, but it's just the truth. Trafficking exists in our state and in this country because there is a market for it. Mm-hmm. It's because people will purchase this illegal, exploitative labor. And that is true all over the state of Missouri. They don't just purchase it. Folks don't just purchase it in urban areas. They purchase it in rural areas. And that's why we both have to clamp down on the supply by making it hard for traffickers, making it costly for traffickers to pursue these crimes. And we also have to have social change. We have to educate people and say, look, this is exploitation of the weak and vulnerable, and we need to turn off the demand as well.
You know, Mike, along those lines, if you would, tell us the story of Rachel Pointer. She's an Omaha woman who was first sold for sex when she was, and folks, you aren't going to believe this, when she was 6 years old.
Yeah, it's a really hard one to even imagine that sort of thing happens. Again, young woman lived in a very busy house where it was kind of easy to, you know, for things to happen without people seeing it. There was a neighbor that lived next door that first raped her and then began selling her. And, you know, he used, which is very common, the threats of harm to her friends and families to control her. Also drugs and alcohol. And this went on for her for a period of 10 years where she would be, you know, called out by the people trafficking her to, you know, come out of the house in the middle of the night. She'd be moved around the Omaha area. You know, there were signs, but they didn't necessarily, you know, they weren't caught by the people who should have caught them. And again, it went on until she was about 16 years old.
You know, Mike, how does this happen? Again, some folks listening might be wondering why at some point doesn't she just walk away?
Well, again, the traffickers, unfortunately, are good at what they do. They understand vulnerabilities. We interviewed one man who was part of a trafficking operation in Omaha for quite a while who talked about what he did, and the word he used was vulnerable. He sought vulnerable people, and then they used different control mechanisms, whether it's drugs, alcohol. You know, threats are huge, threats to family, threats to friends. Isolation, which is an important part of what they say, how this happens in rural areas, taking people away from their comfort zone and their friends and family.
So you keep them under your control 24/7 through these different techniques, if I understand saying you're right, Mike.
Right. That's what the experts will say, yes.
Yeah. General, I'm wondering about the kinds of stories that you've heard about what's happening in Missouri, because I know there was a case in Columbia not long ago. Is there one or a case out there that has really come across your plate that you had trouble imagining?
Well, the case in Colombia is an illustrative one since you mentioned it, Steve.
Yeah.
Here you have an FBI raid, you know, right here in the middle part of the state, in the more rural portion of the state, an FBI raid that uncovered, I believe it was three different women who had been forced into commercial sex exploitation. One of them, and this is really telling, one of them was a Wisconsin girl who had been trafficked from Wisconsin down here to Missouri. She had been previously classified as a runaway, quote unquote, in Wisconsin. And this is something that we see more and more often, that young women who appear just to leave home or be lured away from home for no apparent reason, well, they're not actually just leaving for no reason. They have encountered a predator online, sometimes in person. They have been lured away with false promises, and here they are. And then just as Mike is describing, they get trafficked into this industry, and then their traffickers use force, they use drugs, they use other coercion to keep them in this life. And so this is why the steps we're taking here in Missouri, I have issued new regulations under my consumer protection authority to go after traffickers using our consumer protection laws. So we've said, look, if you as a trafficker promise something of value to your victim and use that promise to induce them into commercial sexual exploitation, that is illegal now. Under these regulations in the state of Missouri, we can impose both civil and criminal penalties. We're also going after businesses that act as fronts for trafficking rings, and that's something else that we see commonly. A business will pose as a massage parlor or a nail salon or a bar, but behind it, you have a forced prostitution ring, a trafficking ring. We want to go after those as well.
Mike, Frank Morris here at KCUR has done stories on truckers organizing to fight sex trafficking on the nation's highways. Any sense if this is proving to be an effective deterrent?
Not certain about it, that as much. I'm aware of the organization Truckers Against Trafficking. I don't know that they're as active in Nebraska as they are in other areas. You know, the experts, Anna Brewer, who used to be an FBI agent and now works for does some work for the state's Human Trafficking Task Force, will say that, you know, that I-80 and I-29, the interstates, are a big part of the business model. So obviously, you know, truckers being aware and being involved is significant.
Mike, what have you learned from the survivors you interviewed for your series in terms of things we might learn from them that would help us stop this practice from continuing forever?
You know, the big thing is that awareness that it happens. They all said that, you know, as they talk to people, they didn't, you know, people don't believe that this happens. They don't believe it happens in Nebraska or in Kansas or in Missouri. They don't believe it happens in rural areas. You know, the other thing is just being aware. The number, you know, experts will say that often people that are being trafficked come in contact with a first responder who, for whatever reason, doesn't ask that question, that doesn't see what's happening, whether it's law enforcement. One woman that we interviewed who was more or less kidnapped, taken to Chicago, and then moved to another state. At one point, the car was pulled over for speeding, and she was there in the front, had been visibly beaten, and nobody asked that question.
General Hawley, again, in the state of Missouri, which you represent here, is that kind of training going on, this notion of getting law enforcement to become more aware of this problem? And what's your hope for what might be happening in Missouri going forward?
We need more training, Steve, all across the state, for our law enforcement officials at all levels. But we also need them, as Mike is just alluding to, we need them for folks who are on the front lines of the trafficking fight but may not realize it. Healthcare professionals, court officials. We know that children who are in the foster care system are particularly at risk for trafficking and at risk to traffickers. So we need training in those areas. And that's why I've created a statewide task force that the Attorney General's office will chair to bring together law enforcement from across our state, the state of Missouri, and also those who are working in the nonprofit sector, both to prevent these crimes from happening and then to care for victims afterwards. And one of the goals of the task force is to develop a model training curriculum for law enforcement and to see that implemented across the state, and then also for those like healthcare workers and others who are coming into contact with trafficking victims, but they just don't know it. The last thing I would say on this, Steve, is that we have created a hotline, a trafficking hotline, in the state of Missouri as well. And our hope is, as the training becomes more widespread, as everyday folks learn to recognize the signs of trafficking, that there will be increased reports that we can then investigate and prosecute.
General, I've just got a couple minutes left, and I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you about the alleged pay-to-play scandal going on right now in the State House. Missouri Senate Leader Ron Richard received a campaign contribution from prominent business owner David Humphreys after introducing a bill that would make it harder for consumers to sue businesses like his for false advertising. Do you think these allegations are something that need investigating, and does your office have a role in all this, General?
You know, well, pay-to-play allegations are always serious. Now, we do not, my office does not have criminal jurisdiction over pay-to-play allegations. And so those are, the jurisdiction lies with the local prosecutor, in this case, the Cole County prosecutor, or the United States attorney. I will say that we need to be careful, however, Steve, in this instances like this, and in this particular instance, to make sure that we don't mistake pay-to-play with just ordinary free speech. I mean, there's nothing wrong with a donor giving a campaign contribution to a public official that is made out in the open, that's duly reported, and supporting a policy that he or she thinks is good for the state. So we have to be careful that we don't criminalize free speech. But, you know, I ran on a platform saying that we would clean up. I would be part of the solution in Jefferson City. That's why I instituted what we believe is the toughest ethics policy of any attorney general's office in the country. My first day in office, I pledged that I would not accept gifts. No member of the attorney general's office is permitted to accept lobbyist gifts. And I also said I would not accept campaign contributions from anyone who is being investigated by my office. So we're proud of that policy. We're working hard to implement it. We hope that that's a model. And we're going to continue to do everything we can to make sure that we go after the culture of corruption in this city and in politics.
Now, I should mention that I'm a member of the STARS editorial board, which last week called for an investigation into all this. Just quickly, General, does the state need a tougher ethics commission, a tougher ethics set of policies for statewide lawmakers and state officials?
Well, I'm in favor of ethics reform, absolutely. And one of the things that I have long been in favor of is a total gift ban. And that's why I implemented it in my office as a matter of office policy on my first day in office. So I think that we need tough new rules that say, look, if you get elected as a public official, not only should you have to disclose every dime in campaign contributions, as we currently do, but you should not be able to accept gifts from lobbyists. I think that would go a long way towards restoring public confidence. And then my office has gone further, and we have also said that in addition to the gift ban, which we've implemented, if you come to the Attorney General's office and you try to influence in any way the policy or conduct of this office, then you have to register as a lobbyist.
Okay.
You have to go and file a public registration. So we want to do our part in that way and challenge the other branches of government to follow suit.
I want to thank the Attorney General of Missouri, Josh Hawley. General, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Also here today, Mike Tobias, a reporter for Net News up in Nebraska. Mike, thank you very much.
And thank you for having me.
It's time now for State House Blend Kansas. After last year's election, when a bunch of moderate Republicans joined the Kansas legislature, many talked about a possible coalition with the Democrats. As the 2017 legislative session nears its end, host Sam Zeff sat down with political science professor Patrick Miller and Senator Barbara Bollier to see if that coalition ever became a reality.
Barbara, I'm going to start with you. Early on, the moderates and Democrats pushed a bill to restore teacher tenure, which is really due process for public school teachers, to the House. And many thought, well, there it is. There's the coalition. The legislation stalled when it hit the Senate. It's in the Ways and Means now committee, which means it could come back. Do you think that there was a coalition that had formed between moderate Republicans and Democrats that made it look like there was going to be this progressive agenda that was going to just spread like wildfire through the State House?
Sam, to me, things progressed exactly as I would have predicted, in that, yes, on the House side, there is a huge majority if you put moderates and Democrats together. And that's what I anticipated would happen, and they would vote things through. While on the Senate side, that is not the case. It still is a significant number when you put moderates and Democrats together, but it's not a majority. Nobody has a majority. And so, yes, people are working together depending on the issue, especially if you're looking at a veto override proof, which is absolutely what we need in Kansas these days, there aren't enough numbers.
But you would say that there is more working together across all kinds of ideological lines this session than you've seen in the past couple?
Absolutely. And at least people are talking now. And I think that's true on the House side as well. That's what I hear from my colleagues on that side, that the leadership we have is now allowing conversation to take place, bills to move forward. So to say that there is a coalition that's going to move a specific agenda forward, yes and no. People try, but I think you're going to see a significant change to that idea when we get to school funding. And that is not going to be the coalition. That isn't how it's going to play out when we get to that issue.
And we're going to talk about that, but I want to bring Patrick Miller in here. You crunch numbers for a living over there at the University of Kansas, and we've had the pleasure of having you on our air on election night, on primary election night. And I'm wondering, as you saw the election wrap up, did you see the hints of a coalition forming just from the election results back in November?
I mean, I guess that for me, the place to start is even the word coalition, because it carries a lot of implications that maybe are there sometimes and maybe aren't. And I think that if we go back to the election, there were a lot of people who felt that because moderates and Democrats had made gains, there was all of a sudden going to be this, you know, kumbaya, feel good, everyone's on the same page block of people who are going to change legislation in Kansas. And I mean, that's not necessarily the case. I mean, moderates are a very diverse group. And certainly you have a situation for moderates where even though on many issues they may agree politically with Democrats, or many of them do, there is that pressure at the same time. You know, you're still caucusing with the Republican Party, which has a lot of conservatives in it. And there's that pressure, you know, when can you expend political capital to defect from where conservatives are, vote with Democrats, and when do you need to, and no one take this the wrong way, toe the party line on a vote because there's pressure coming from the speaker or whomever. So there are a lot of different pressures at place here on a legislator who, you know, is thinking about how they're going to vote. So for those of us from the outside who are like, rah, rah, coalition, something big is going to happen, there'll be big change, I think we need to appreciate just the diversity there is politically among moderates especially, and all the different pressures there are on them to you know, think about different constituencies and political players in supporting certain legislation.
So if it's not a coalition, then how would you describe it, Patrick?
I mean, again, it feels like it often varies. I mean, I think previously to this session, it often looked like a group of people who were often united by knowing what they were against, which was against a lot of the things the governor was proposing, some of the more controversial legislation. You know, certainly moderates, Democrats have more power now. It may be more difficult to find what you're for and advance an agenda oftentimes, whereas there might be a lot more solidarity in knowing that you don't want to continue down the road that you've been on.
So you've come together. There is certainly more talking as we've talked about, but you've still yet to pass legislation that solves some of these enormous problems that you just talked about: taxes, budget, school finance. And it's clear from what's happened previously, governor vetoes, don't have override votes, that to fix something, because you've got to come up with a budget. That's the one thing you have to do. Well, you also have to do school finance, or else the Supreme Court's going to shut down public education. When you come back on May 1st, will there have to be more compromise and more talking across ideological lines to solve this? Because I think a lot of people thought that, you know, we were going to there was going to be a lot of working together. A lot of these big things were going to be solved before you left for this break. So while there won't be a coalition, aren't you guys going to have to, you know, buckle down and get your work done and work across lines?
Well, the answer is it is in that sense, the word coalition, I agree, Patrick, that it's just not the right word. There are people working together to get something passed. So we are way closer to the override numbers than we are to what the governor wants with only Republican votes to pass what it is that he wants. So I think that's out the window. And what we have to do is work on the very few numbers of people that it's going to take to get to the override numbers. But bargains start being struck. If you'll give me a vote on guns, I'll give you a vote on school funding or whatever. That's how things happen at the end. So that's what you're going to see happening.
Is it too early, Patrick Miller, to be looking forward to 2018 and saying, what are these guys now doing that could have an effect on those legislative races in 2018?
Never. But I also want to say is, I mean, as a political scientist, I always start from the perspective of, well, what's the context of this? And it starts from the top down. I mean, and the top is the presidential situation. I mean, that often drives midterms for one party or another. Typically, the party of a president loses seats in midterms, not just federally, but at the state level. So that may be a challenge for many Republicans, whether you're a moderate or a conservative, depending upon the kind of district or state you're running in. If we look here at Kansas, you know, it's not like voters become a blank slate about the last 8 years when they're replacing a chief executive, whether it's a governor or a president. And how they feel about the brownback years could shape the mood they're in, their willingness to vote for a Democrat or a Republican of some flavor in the gubernatorial race. So, you know, if you're a Republican, you're looking at a midterm where you not only have Trump at the top, but also some negativity around brownback that may cause you some challenges. And you can only do so much to affect that around the edges. You know, you try to do what you can to ride a wave if a wave is building. And this is why we're paying so much attention now to special elections for state legislatures and Congress to see if we see trends starting to build. You know, but I think if at least where we sit today, I mean, the election is a year and a half off. We don't even know who's running for state legislative seats, let alone Congress. You know, if you're a Republican, you should probably be on yellow alert about what's happening. You know, the CLACS, you know, the Starship Enterprise red alert has not started quite yet. But, you know, putting the tea leaves together, you might want to start positioning yourself as well as you can. And if you're a Democrat, you might be a little eager and be looking for opportunities given where the winds are blowing. But that's a long way off.
And we'll leave it there. This is where we turn State House Blend over to you guys. You're both going to give me a walk-off song, and then I will pick the winner. Barbara, we'll start with you.
One of my favorite pieces of music is Dances with Wolves, their songs. And I am thinking of that in terms of the politics because we are still in a den of wolves, but we're going to have to get along and hoping that the people will come over and vote where we can move forward.
Patrick Miller, your song.
If I had to pick something on the spot, maybe appropriate to the political mood these days, especially in Kansas, I might go with Bittersweet Symphony by The Verve.
And I'm going to be honest and say I don't really like either of those songs, but I like Barbara's story the best. So we're going to go with with a theme from Dances with Wolves. State House Blend is produced by Matt Hodapp and Amy Jeffries today. I'm Sam Zeff. I'll see you around the radio.
That was from KCUR State House Blend, Kansas. Tomorrow on the show, find out what's going on at LitFest KC this weekend. And warfare is violent by nature. We'll see if it's possible to make it ethical, too. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.